Part 3 of 6 from set number 1009, C.G. Jung's 7 Sermons. This is a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Cosmic Opposites, Gnostic Creative Dualism Expressed Psychologically.
And with that, I think we can address this evening's topic, this being within the series of commentaries about the 7 Sermons to the Dead. As you have noted probably earlier, I do not quote in the lectures inevitably the entire text of the sermons, because it's quite lengthy, but only the ones that I feel that can be more readily highlighted for our purposes. But if you would like to have the entire text of the sermons, as well as perhaps my much longer commentaries to them, they are still available in my book that was published years ago, remained in print ever since, The Gnostic Jung and the 7 Sermons to the Dead. If I may say so myself, it wasn't very badly written. truly, it was my first major book, and I truly poured into it everything that was within my psyche at that particular time. I was so worn out and so wrung out afterwards that I outwardly and inwardly resembled a lemon that had been used for the purpose of a large quantity of lemonade. So I don't know whether that's a recommendation or not. Maybe that will sour you on the prospect of getting the book. But it was really not a bad book. In any event, now we are addressing it in a somewhat different way. And we have, in the course of our earlier talks, dealt with the first, the second, and the third sermon. And we saw that Jung is unfolding in the 7 sermons a kind of, quintessential skeletal structure of his Gnostic psychology. And in so doing, in this poetic treatise written very much in the style and with much of the terminology of second or third century Gnosticism, he began with the pleroma, with the ultimate ground of being, with the transcendental reality, about which, by his own admission, very little can be said, but he wrote one of the longest sermons about that, nevertheless, even though so little can be said about it, because that's the way those things usually go. And then, sort of in descending order now, we are dealing with the various emanations, let's say, of the original reality, and each one of these has some relevance to Jung's psychology, because as I quoted his statements from Memories, Dreams, and Reflections earlier, he had freely admitted that all of his subsequent work was contained in these initial insights, Initial Imaginationen, as he called them in German. And we finished off last time with the awesome figure of Abraxas, which somehow really grabbed Jung particularly powerfully, and it is written in a most awe-inspiring and at times sort of downright frightening manner. And we indicated at that time that under Abraxas, Jung understands primarily the underlying power, the energy of universal being and of the human psyche that makes for the union of the opposites, the union of the opposites. And that indeed to accomplish such a task, whether within us or outside of us, takes a tremendous amount of force, and that force he represented as Abraxas. So it's a little different representation from the mythic figure of Abraxas as it appears in the Gnostic scriptures, at least the ones that we know of, yet compatible with them. Now, since we have encountered this downright Nietzschean description of that awesome figure that works for the union and reconciliation and the union with the opposites, it behooves us to have some glimpse of what these opposites are. What is it that Abraxas is uniting? And that is precisely the subject that is addressed both in the fourth and in the fifth sermon, which are the subject of our discussion this evening. So I will read now the portions of the fourth sermon, which we feel are of particular interest to us, and then we'll comment on them, and then, if time allows, I want to wind up with a sort of general statement, which I may continue with next time, of the true underlying relationship of Jung's teachings with Gnosticism, especially as it relates to the opposites, what people often in a pejorative manner refer to as the dualism of the Gnostics. But now the fourth sermon. Grumbling, the dead filled the room and said, "Speak to us about gods and devils, thou accursed one." You know, the dead, whoever they may be, are a sort of ill-tempered bunch. And every time, they always come back again, but they always excoriate, they always maltreat their teacher when they come. You know, come on, tell us about that. You know, this kind of nasty business. So now, here he teaches them in the fourth sermon. God the Son, S-U-N, is the highest good. The devil is the opposite. He mentioned this already prior to Abraxas. Thus you have two gods, a good one and a bad one. Sort of a little bit Zoroastrian in nature. Or people often call that Manichaean, while that is not really true Manichaeanism. But there are many great goods and many vast evils, and among them there are two god-devils, dash, combination, one of which is the burning one and the other the growing one. The burning one is Eros in his form as a flame. It shines and it devours. The growing one is the tree of life. Not the Kabbalistic one, incidentally. It grows green and it accumulates living matter while it grows. Eros flames up and then dies away. The tree of life, however, grows slowly and reaches stately stature throughout countless ages. Good and evil are united in the flame. Good and evil are united in the growth of the tree. Life and love oppose each other in their own divinity. Immeasurable like the host of stars is the number of gods and devils. Now, I use the term devil, other translators, and there are not too many, have used often demon, but Jung uses the word Teufel, which is the German word for devil. And therefore, while it may be off-putting to some, none of us like to hear too much about devils. As Father Brown, you know, Chesterton's chocolate-eating clerical detective, said at one time, somebody asked him, "Father Brown, do you believe in the devil?" And he said, "Of course I believe in the devil. Otherwise, I might have to believe that I am the devil myself." Which shows a little bit of sort of quasi-Jungian insight on the part of old G.K. Chesterton, you know. In any event, that's the word, so that's the one that I used. Every star is a god, and every space occupied by a star is a devil. And the emptiness of the whole is the pleroma, within which it all exists. The activity of the whole is Abraxas. Only the unreal opposes him. In any event, incidentally, for those who are interested in those matters, while it's of course highly metaphorical, but then so is everything along these lines, it is rather close to what the redoubtable Madame Blavatsky says in her Secret Doctrine, where she sort of uses as a synonym for what here is called the pleroma space, and by which she doesn't mean just really ordinary space, but an immeasurable duration within which these various opposites and the worlds and the universes arise and disappear. So Jung undoubtedly was familiar with Blavatsky, but I doubted that he took it from there. And more about all that a bit later. Then he goes on saying, "Blessed am I, the teacher, for it is granted unto me to know the multiplicity and diversity of the gods. Woe unto you, for you have substituted the oneness of God, with a capital G, for the diversity which cannot be resolved into the one. Through this you have created the torment of incomprehension, and the mutilation of the created world, the essence and law of which is diversity. How can you be true to your nature when you attempt to make one out of the many? What you do to the gods, that also befalls you. All of you are made thus the same, and in this way your nature also becomes mutilated. For the sake of man there may reign unity, but never for the sake of God, because there are many gods, but only few men. The gods are mighty, and they bear their diversity, because like the stars, they stand in solitude and are separated by vast distances one from the other. Humans are weak and cannot bear their own diversity, because they live close to each other and are desirous of company, so that they cannot bear their own distinct separateness. For the sake of salvation do I teach you that which is to be cast out, for the sake of which I myself have been cast out. The multiplicity of the gods equals the multiplicity of men. Countless gods are waiting to become men. Countless gods have already been men. Man is a partaker of the essence of the gods. He comes from the gods and goes to God," with the capital G again. And then he speaks some more of the light gods and the dark gods, and he concludes the sermon by saying, "There is no difference in the power of the heavenly and the earthly gods. The heavenly ones expand, the earthly ones diminish. Both directions stretch into infinity." Now we might as well take a look at some little exegetical ideas on these matters. So he speaks first of all of the big duality, which is almost like the duality that sort of is the most important. Perhaps it encompasses many of the others. Perhaps from this primordial duality emanate other dualities. And this he calls the burning one and the growing one. My mind, which is sort of infused with imagery from the tarot, this always brings to my mind the tarot card of the lovers in the Weight deck, executed by Pamela Coleman Smith, where you have the two lovers standing there. Each one stands in front of a tree. But the tree that is behind one of them, behind the man, has flames coming out of it. And the other one has fruit. So the burning one and the growing one. So this duality is taken roughly from the worldview of the ancient Greeks, believe it or not. Because the Greeks spoke of the two at what they called world spirits, and they are called Eros and Logos. Eros, Jung mentions the very name, in the Greek view already, is characterized by burning energy, by creativity, by feeling, by passion, by desire. But not particularly sexual desire, but rather this is a powerful energetic keynote at the level of the psyche, which is of course where ultimately really everything comes from. Because to quote again Madame Blavatsky, all the universes are governed from within outwards. So this is the burning one. The burning one is Eros, the world spirit Eros, as the Greeks envisioned it. Nietzsche, who was of course primarily a a classicist, Nietzsche called this the Dionysian side of nature, because he felt that the truly energetic and weird and wild figure of the god Dionysus characterized that Eros principle of universal being. Passionate and creative, fierce, which of course are pretty much the characteristics of Dionysus and of his followers, because when they got into their ecstatic state, those people, many of them, or most of them, were primarily women, the Bacchae, which is the Roman name for them, because Bacchus is the Roman equivalent of Dionysus. Those were wild women. If you ever, you ever want to know something about wild women, that they were the wild women. They were wild in a lot of ways. Any body or any creature that got in their way when they were racing around in the mountains there in their altered states, they just tore them apart. So, that's kind of interesting to hear about, but I sure wouldn't have liked to encounter those ladies up there. But of course, it all fits in mythologically, because these are the sort of things that happened to Dionysus to begin with. He was torn apart, then later on he was put back together. Now, one of the characteristics of the flame, that he uses the flame, is what? That, no matter how fiercely it may burn, when the fuel is gone, the flame burns out. I mean, even these terrible fires that we get around here, they wreak awful destruction, but when it's over, it's over. Sometimes by the time it's over, everything is burned out, but it's over. And so the flame has that. There is a time and term, a relatively short one, to the fire. When there is no more fuel, the fire is gone. I hesitate to admit that my people were genetically and otherwise descent from the Hungarians. Their temperament is often described by the Hungarians themselves as the straw flame, Salma Lang in Hungarian. Because the Hungarians flare up, and then it's over, So if you manage to survive while they flared up, then you're okay, So that is the characteristic, so to say, of that flame. Well, maybe there is some Hungarian genetic heritage in a lot of the Americans too, because, when something nasty happens, like, say, 9/11, then certainly we all flared up very much too, But now after there are a couple of 2-3 years in Iraq, the fuel burns out and said, oh well, forget it, let's get the hell out of there, And we did the same in Vietnam, very much to the chagrin of many Vietnamese and of the million in Cambodia who perished. So, there is an upside and a downside to that flame. You flare up, and then afterwards you are no longer burning, shall we say. We might also say at the human level, if we want to be a sort of a little bit physiologically oriented there, that this is the adrenaline-related side of psychology. When the adrenaline flows, then people are fiery and they get, angry and whatever the case may be. And when the adrenaline supply is out, then you just get tired. Gerald Hurd, the great philosopher, whom I have a great deal of respect for, he actually used to refer to certain people as adrenaline addicts. They love to get mad, because they feel powerful, they feel alive, When they are not mad, then they are sort of wusses, wimps. They just kind of shamble around. So they have to get mad in order to feel themselves and to feel a very, very bad way to feel alive. But it's certainly there. So all this has to do with this kind of power that is in the world, so the Greeks said and so Jung affirms here, of the burning one. Then the Greeks said that the other great world spirit is what they called logos, which means literally the word, and also might be called articulated psychic energy. When the psychic energy becomes organized to the point that it is expressed in the word or in words, then you have logos. Now, you know, these terms have been used in various ways, and we must distinguish between this ancient Greek concept of logos and the one that was used, say, by Philo of Alexandria and in his wake by St. John the Evangelist, and also by a lot of Gnostics, where logos really means a particular salvific emanation of the ultimate God. Jesus is referred to as the Logos. Gospel of Philip, many of you just called the Logos said, just like that. But this is a little different application of that term, a little more wide-ranging. Nietzsche defined this tendency as Apollonian, because he related it to the god Apollo, who is the god of orderly development, of beauty. And, you know, that's quite important, because the Greeks defined beauty as something that is harmonious and balanced. Anything that is not harmonious and not balanced is not beautiful. And you can see that. I mean, let's see, somebody comes in, and one side of his or her face is, you know, quite nice and symmetrical and whatever. The other side is all off for one reason or the other. Such a person would not be the epitome of human beauty. So it's when the whole body is in proportion and is harmonious, then it is beautiful. Things that are not harmonious and not beautiful might still tell us a message, but at least by definition of the ancient Greeks, that message in that case is not beauty. It might be something else. So what we are dealing with here is the Logos, who is called the Growing One, the Apollonian side of existence and of being, which deals with a harmonious and more or less balanced development. And that is why perhaps Jung called it the Growing One, because it builds methodically and slowly. This principle, as seen by the Greeks and here by Jung, you know, builds cities and civilizations, builds structures, physical as well as mental. So outwardly and inwardly, this principle is one that constructs, and therefore these constructs tend to endure, whether they are outwardly in civilization or the inner civilization in the mind or in the psyche. So we need to keep these two opposites then in mind. One burns, namely, you might say, operates speedily. And, you know, much creative development operates in that fashion. When you are really fired up to write a poem or to paint a picture or to sculpt a sculpture or whatever the case may be, you feel a sense of urgency to do it. You know, you can't sleep, you don't want to sleep, and you really want to do this. And you try to arrange your time and everything in such a way that you'll be able to do that. When you are not doing it, you feel frustrated, you feel out of sorts. A rather extreme example of this was a man I read about. Very few people know about him nowadays. He was a sort of political philosopher in the late 19th century, maybe into the early 20th century, Houston Stuart Chamberlain. He was an Englishman who lived in Europe, however, in Germany, and was very popular in Germany and some other places his writings were. He would ride on the train, say in northern Italy or somewhere, and boom, all of a sudden the inspiration would hit him. So he'd get off the train, no matter where he was, ran to the first inn or hotel or whatever was available, rented a room, sat down and wrote, and wrote, and wrote, and wrote. And never slept. Two or three days, 4 days, day and night, he would write and write and write. Then he was finished. I guess his books weren't terribly long. Then he lied down and slept, day and night, for God knows how long. Then He packed up, got his suitcase, and got on the train and went to wherever he was supposed to go. I mean, you know, seized by that particular inspiration or impulse of creativity. And therefore, let's say, there is an upside and a downside to all of these, of course. And I'll see about that a little bit later. But as, let's say, the growing one, on the other hand, which he calls the tree of life, it builds. You know, it builds slowly structures, like pyramids, cities, civilizations, outwardly. And inwardly, ideas and whole systems of ideas, internal systematizations, intellectualizations that go on and on. And just because they have grown slowly like that, they also don't fall, they don't get destroyed fast. They remain, they have a certain endurance. Of course, there is a time and term for everything, as Gurdjieff said, that nothing lasts forever in this world, but what comes about in this fashion has a long lifespan, so to say. Now, we might say that, oh well, you know, speaking again of these contrasts, Shakespeare already said, speaking of this inspiration, the poet's eye in a fine frenzy rolling. So, when the poet is inspired, it's like a frenzy. That is the burning one. And the sermons say that these two, namely the burning one and the growing one, are, quote, as you heard, God devils. Now this means that each has a side of light and a dark side, you know. So the burning one shows its dark side easily. Impulsiveness, unpremeditated violence, rash actions and judgments, sudden explosions of wrath. You get the picture, collectively and individually. You know, sometimes it's as difficult to be around people like that who are dominated by that as it's to live in the immediate vicinity of an active volcano. You never know when you're going to get burnt by the burning one. And the dark side of the growing one is not that easily revealed, for which reason it's really, in the long run, more dicey, more difficult. The Apollonian side, the dark side of that is not so easily discerned. But, oh dear, is it ever powerfully present? Well, let's say what comes to my mind because of more recent developments over the last century and so, are mental constructs. The way the growing one develops big, vast, seemingly all-encompassing theories. Well, there was a fellow with a kind of a grizzly beard and unkempt hair, by the name of Karl Marx, and he sat around in the reading room of the British Museum, I believe, day after day after day, and he was engaged in constructing, in writing, an incredibly complex and terribly impressive intellectual system. And his book was Das Kapital. And look what came of it. The Gulag Archipelago, the killing fields of Cambodia, and the countless millions slaughtered by Mao Zedong, the number of which now the historians believe is larger than the victims of Stalin and of Hitler put together. Chairman Mao in his little red book, you know. No wonder it was red. And what was behind all of this? Well, a bunch of nasty people, of course. But what was behind them? A structure. An intellectual construct which they worshipped and for the sake of which they did the most atrocious things. And where the people are able to, they still do. This is the dark side of the growing one. See, an Apollonian construct is so impressive. It's archetypal in nature. You look at it and it's flawless. It's flawless on paper. It's flawless in theory. but it's disastrous when applied. That's why one should not fall in love with one's ideas. Ideas are okay, but in themselves and of themselves, the ideas can become idols. There is a little similarity there in the way they sound. But when you start worshipping your own ideas or ideas that you have made your own, you usually set yourself up for some very difficult developments. So it's true everywhere. And people can very seldom see really how very, very imperfect the application of their perfect Apollonian ideas is when they go ahead and do it. And little example, which I haven't quoted now for a few years, so I might as well quote it again, came to my attention years ago in connection with a beautiful little place out here in the ocean across the waters from San Pedro and around there called Catalina Island, named after St. Catherine of Alexandria. So it should have some relationship to Alexandrian ideas anyway. So on Catalina Island, there are various critters, including to some people. And some of these are my favorite animals, both in theoretically and practically. Theoretically, because I basically like them. They are cute animals. And practically is because I have a liking for them in a culinary sense. I like to eat them. And these are pigs. Pigs, you know. Pigs are remarkable creatures. So the Spanish sailors long, long ago, as was their wont, brought some pigs and let them loose on the island so that they would breed, and then when other sailors would come later on, they would have something to eat. You know, they did that in all kinds of places. Other sailors did too. Captain Cook did it with the pigs that he let loose in New Zealand. And they are to this day called the Captain Cookers. Captain Cookers. It has, a little culinary touch there, you know. In any event, here are these pigs in Catalina Island, and, you know, they root and around and they eat and all of that, and then there are certain times when the conservancy organization there decimates them a bit so that they won't eat up the whole island. Well, along came the little green people. Not the ones from outer space, but the ones that are, you know, the green people. And the green people said, oh, we have to defend the environment of Catalina Island. We have to defend the plants, see? And how do we do that? So they kept sneaking on the island and shooting the pigs, like poachers, you know? And, you know, the different unpleasant things developed out of that. So here you have again this Apollonian mind that gets an idea, the plants are more important than the animals, certainly more important than the pigs. Then the other problem were the goats, but we won't go into that, because that would get your goat, so forget it. You know. But you see here again, in other words, it doesn't matter as much as to what the particular orientation is. The mind becomes obsessed with its own ideas, and it does not take into account in what way, in what manner these ideas are being implemented on earth. And that's why, you know, a reality check for one's ideas is always very, very important. A lot of horrible things in this world would not have happened if such serious reality checks had occurred, but they don't. Because one becomes infatuated with one's system of ideas. Now then, the burning one and the growing one thus both have a dark side, have a good side. I mean, look, we still, construction, beautiful things, we can still go to Greece and see what is left, or we can go to the British Museum and see the Elgin marbles. This is Apollonian construction. And we can still enjoy it after all this long time. But the Apollonian way of dealing with reality also has a downside. And there it becomes obsessive. And it's destructive. So the two world spirits are then the prime example of the opposites in the life of the world and in the life of the psyche. And you can see that, you know, the I'm not talking now in contemporary American political terms, because, you know, these words have much, much wider and older implications. But let's say the essentially conservative mind is on the side of the growing one. It wants to conserve. It wants to conserve what is, you know. Let's see, maybe the best examples of that kind of conservatism in a fairly concrete manner are the efforts of Prince Charles, the Crown Prince of England, trying to preserve the architecture of London. You know? Quite understandable. So there is the tendency to try to conserve what is and keep it going. And then there is the other one, the innovative, the revolutionary, change, 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 you know, that's the burning one. You know? And so what do we do as humans? We alternate, we bounce back and forth between these, you know, bounce back and forth. One year, Louis XVI, the poor old clockmaking king, you know, sits on his throne in France. Another year, everybody's head is cut off by the guillotine. And another couple of years later, Napoleon is sitting on an even bigger and shinier throne than there was earlier on. Back and forth, bounce back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Like those old-fashioned pinball machines. I'm sure they have been supplanted by now with computer games. But bounce back and forth, back and forth. And Jung's justified feeling is, you know what? As long as you keep doing that, you're not getting anywhere. You're treading water. You're staying in one place. Now you are at this end of the polarity, and now you bounce back to this one. You're not getting anywhere. How are you getting anywhere? Is when you somehow begin to get in the middle and reconcile these things, and then kind of use the energy of both to get on, to move on, you know. But humans don't do that. Well, they do eventually, you know. But it's something that we have to do within ourselves, and something that is also quite nice when we can do it outwardly. So this is the big, big principle which he is enunciating here. The fourth sermon also goes to mention other dualities. He says, immeasurable is the number of gods and devils. He makes a plea for a kind of mystical psychological polytheism. He says the diversity of the gods cannot be resolved into the one. Now, what is he saying here? So the dualities, the dual powers have to be recognized, in part because then can they be resolved. A kind of simple-minded monism or monotheism does not help, because it does not take the multiplicity into account. Now here once again, the kind of, which he puts right into the sermons too, the kind of Gnostic insight comes into play. Because he did speak of a one. He did speak of an ultimate reality. He even uses the term God with a capital G here and there. But where is that? It's above the realm of the duality. Way up high, the fullness, the ultimate reality. That is the only one, and that is one. And I'll speak a little more, if I can, toward the latter part of our discussion about the duality and the resolution of duality in a strictly Gnostic sense. But that is kind of the issue. But instead of that, what we do, and what we have done religiously, we have projected our need for monism or monotheism onto a lesser level. You can see that just by studying the history of the origins of various religions. How do monotheistic religions pick their one God? I'll tell you how. They usually pick one God out of the then existing polytheistic pantheon and say, this is the one, and do away with all the others. Allah was a god among many gods of the old Babylonian, the kind of leftover Babylonian Sabian pantheon. He even had a wife called Allat. You know? And along came Muhammad and said, over there, that's the one, he's the only god. There is only one God and he is Allah. Picked out of the others. Many other situations of that sort. That's the way it usually happens, you know. In fact, you know, it was even tried in a much more feeble manner in India. In the 19th century, there was a movement in India, religious movement called the Brahma Samaj. Its founder was Mohun something Roy. And what these folk tried to do is they said, we are really monotheists. There is really only one God and that is Brahma. And the others are sort of aspects of the one, you know. So people try that. But what we are doing then when we pick on this level of duality is we pick one and say this is the really the true one, the only one, the one, is then that that one has very peculiar qualities, as indeed is true, let's say, with Yahweh and so forth. Why? Because he is really started out as one of many. And he is angry, and he is jealous, and he is cruel, and he is not very bright at times. You know, he walks around in paradise looking for Adam, here, the all-knowing one, and he doesn't know where Adam is. And then he cries out, Adam, where are you? You know, and Adam says, here I am. And I think, so what you do is when you pick a unitary God at a level that is manifest, that is imperfect, that the Gnostic would say conic, you have a bad bargain. And no wonder the monotheistic religions all are suffering from that particular affliction. Of course, the polytheistic religions have their own afflictions, because everything in this world has an affliction. So now, psychologically speaking, again, he says, look, you know, there are all of these archetypal powers, and I certainly don't have the time to define an archetype now, but all kinds of powers, beings, things that you see in your dreams, all sorts of things, and their opposites. So the thing is, you know, recognize them and deal with them. And then, in due course of time, using the power of Abraxas, you'll be able to bring them together. And then, by reconciling the opposites, instead of throwing in your lot always with one of the opposites, you'll be able to escape their magnetism, their thraldom, their way in which they pull you into their orbit all the time, and you'll be able to progress to higher spiritual thought. And that is why he said, these gods are not to be worshipped, says the sermon. What does that mean? Don't associate yourself with them. Don't make them the big desirable thing, but just look at them, realize what they are, and utilize, let's say, their power, so that they must be recognized and brought into consciousness and then reconciled. Now, the fifth sermon. Fortunately, as we are moving on with these sermons, they get shorter. The longest ones are at the beginning. The dead were full of mocking and cried, teach us, thou fool, about church and holy community. So they get more and more obstreperous. So the teacher goes on and tells them, the world of the gods is manifest. Now he brings in another duality. In spirituality and sexuality. The heavenly gods appear in spirituality. The earth gods appear in sexuality. So it's a kind of a up and down image of duality. Spirituality receives and comprehends. It is feminine and therefore we call it Mater Celestis, the heavenly mother. Sexuality generates and creates. It is masculine and therefore we call it Phallos, the earthly father. The sexuality of man is more earthly. The sexuality of woman is more heavenly. The spirituality of man is more heavenly, for it moves in the direction of the greater. On the other hand, the spirituality of woman is more earthly, for it moves in the direction of the smaller. And then he goes on and plays with this theme in all sorts of ways so that it really becomes a little bit redundant. So I will pass some of that by and come to what really this leads up to, where he is answering the question of the dead, because the dead wanted to know about community, about ecclesia, about the organization, about the holy church and the holy community. And here he says, man is weak. By the way, man here is Mensch, and the German term for Mensch, but sometimes it is also Mann. I could not translate it in all that many different words because it would have destroyed really the poetry of the text. So man is weak, therefore community is indispensable. If it is not the community in the sign of the mother, then it is in the sign of the phallos. Not to have community consists of suffering and sickness. Community brings with itself fragmentation and dissolution. Differentiation leads to solitude. Solitude is contrary to community because of the weakness of man's will as opposed to the gods and demons and their inescapable law. There is need for community. For this reason, there shall be as much community as necessary, not for the sake of men, but for the sake of the gods. The gods force you into a community. As much community as they force upon you is necessary, but more than that is evil. Keep that in mind. In the community, each shall be subject to another. Hierarchy, organization. So that the community will be maintained inasmuch as you have need of it. In the solitary state, each one shall be placed above all others, so that he may know himself and avoid servitude. In community there shall be abstinence. In solitude let there be squandering of abundance. For community is the depth, while solitude is the height. The true order in community purifies and preserves. The true order in solitude purifies and increases. Community gives us warmth, while solitude gives us the light. So what we have here now is an other duality, first of all, sexuality and spirituality. So here we are kind of in the realm of the instincts, aren't we? Although Jung includes what he calls spirituality sort of really as an other instinct, perhaps somewhat like what in later on in his psychology he came to call the transcendent function. You know, there is the sensate function, the feeling function, the thinking function, the intuitive function, and then there is the transcendent function. This is, of course, where Jung differs so much from other psychologists, where he says, just like we have an instinct for eating, or we have an instinct for sex, we also have an instinct for transcendence, an instinct for the divine. Okay? And I might add to that, that if we don't satisfy that instinct, we are going to be also very frustrated and very hungry and very thirsty. This is the problem of our culture to a major extent. Because on the one hand, we have the very powerful tendency toward secular, atheistic or agnostic kind of attitudes, which we just say, well, you know, God and divine things, transcendence is just, you know, it's simply irrelevant. Well, when you do that, you're going to get very hungry. You're going to get very thirsty for the divine. And you know what? There is no substitute for it. There is no substitute for it. And it's not enough to think about it even. Which is, of course, the other side. On the other side, you have the religionists, you know, now many fundamentalists and people like that. And there, of course, the idea is that, again, it's the mental construct that is being worshipped. What we think God is. You know, and even that one is very unsatisfactory too. You know, now, I have no great interest in or love for, say, Pentecostalism. I just don't understand it. But why do you think Pentecostalism and born-again phenomenon, to the extent that is genuine and not put on, came about? Because they were ways whereby the fundamentalist and an evangelical Christian tried to get desperately some kind of experience. Not just a belief, but an experience. So that when you get up and shake your hand and start speaking in tongues and so forth, well, it might not be the kind of experience that I like, but obviously some people like it, otherwise there wouldn't be all the Pentecostals around, you know, and so forth. That's one of the ways in which the hunger and the thirst for transcendence asserts itself. Even if it's a relatively shallow channel of the living waters, but there's still something there. So there is an instinct there, instinct of spirituality. And here he puts it in contradistinction to what he calls sexuality, and he really means rather more by it than what it sounds like. And then his further elaborations are obscure. But let's see, just like there is something in the human psyche, and consequently in the human body, which is there from the beginning, and which no doubt is tied up also with the propagation of the species and so forth, and the very, very powerful urge of sexuality is there. But on the other side, there is also the urge toward transcendence. And then he eventually leads it to community and individuality, because he feels that these sort of tend to express themselves. Now, community, he says, is helpful to people. No man is an island, as the poet said. Community, he feels, may be maternal. It's sort of supportive, nourishing, protective, or it may be instinctual, strongly hooked up with sexuality and things like that. But community is always there. Let's say community is like the Mormons, with all the polygamy and things like that, was very much hooked up with instinctuality at certain levels. And in other cases, it's mainly supportive and nourishing. And so you have two great opposites here, which are the solitary state, individuality, and community. And you can't really live without either of them. If you go too much out on the limb in one direction, then you suffer greatly. And if you go too much in the other direction, and for instance, he warns about community as much as he says it's helpful, as much community as necessary. And then he says later on, but more than that is evil. So individuality, and indeed individualism, is one polarity, and community is another. One is depth, the other one is height. So let's say when the importance of community is exaggerated, that is when the individual is forever asked to give up his or her individuality, his or her own sovereignty, for the sake of the group, for the sake of the community. Have you heard that expression? The greater good. You got to do that for the greater good. Sometimes it's important to remember, maybe you are the greater good, you know? Maybe you are the greater good. I have always been convinced that I am the greater good. But that just shows you a bit of Hungarian egotism here. But the issue is that, you know, community can take over, can smother you. And so, up to a certain extent, it is all right. But then after that, you know, don't become too group-minded. Don't become too dependent on the community, whatever that community happens to be, because then the community will become your tyrant, even if that is not an intentional act. It will just develop that way. So this may be one of the areas where we all must sort of practice the reconciliation of the opposites right now, and see how it works if we are to lead a sane and happy existence. We have to learn how to remain ourselves while enjoying as much community as necessary in the form of family, extended family, city, state, nation, and so forth. And when practiced properly, the necessary amount of community can help us, but this should not be done at the expense of individuality. And in this respect, historical and then sociological factors have a lot to do with the way these things often work themselves out. Since the French Revolution, gradually the reality and the power of the extended family structures in the Western world waned. And by the late 19th century, by the 20th century, the nuclear family arose. And there the problem is that it's too small a community. It's the kind of community where everything becomes a little bit too intense. And the result of it is what? All the divorces that we have. When I came to this country, only in California did every other marriage end in divorce. You know, we are always out there, right out in front, whatever the front might be. Now it's the entire nation. The rest of the nation caught up with California in that respect as well. But see, again, there is very little of a larger community where all those psychic energies can be deflected, and so the nuclear family bursts like a nuclear explosion. obviously external factors work into that, but the fact remains, Jung says, these are terribly important needs of the soul, of the psyche, that we need each other. We can't really do without each other. If we try, we suffer greatly. But on the other hand, we also have to maintain our individuality. So when the community forces demand the sacrifice of our individuality, then we can't go along. So it's a very difficult razor-edged path. But it's exactly the kind of path that is in the middle of the opposites, where the opposites meet. That's where the reality resides. That is the demarcation line. That's where the truth is present. And of course, ultimately, no doubt, we also need to keep in mind that in terms of our spiritual development, although even there, others can be helpful to us for a considerable period of time, but sort of the last jump, the ultimate leap of the individual spirit is, as Plotinus put it, the flight of the alone, of the alone. So you may walk with others right close to the edge, but then when you leap into the great divine darkness, which is also the great divine light, that one you do by yourself. Now then, that sort of has a good deal to do with the two sermons that we spoke about. And let me now, for the remaining period of time, which is not an awful lot, address myself to this issue of the Gnostic dualism and how it comes together with Jung's teachings. From the earliest times, the church fathers and various enemies of the Gnostics accused them of being dualists. The charge of dualism that was always there. And there are really two kind of major accusatory definitions that we are dealing with historically, but only one of these causes still serious reverberations today. The definitions are as follows. Here are the enemies of the Gnostics, the church fathers, also enemies of Jung, Let's say, Gnostics are people who believe that the Lord God of Israel and of the Christians, the creator of heaven and earth, is an inferior blind power, a demiurge, and that they believe that the material world being created by this imperfect creator is also evil and stands thus in a negative contrast to the world of spirit, which is pure and holy. This latter one is the second accusation. The first one is about God, the second one about the world. Now, not too many people, except of course our ever-present and increasingly troublesome fundamentalists and people like that, would give us a lot of trouble about the concept of the demiurge. So the alleged blasphemous insult to the Lord God of the Old Testament really doesn't arouse the violent indignation that it might have aroused in the 3rd century. I don't think too many people are going to throw rocks at me or at us for that. But the other is still the problem. How dare the Gnostics say that this beautiful world, the world of trees and flowers, of babbling brooks and shining mountains, is not good? And how can they say that the body in which we live is likewise not all that good? Particularly strong is the reaction against such notions on the part of all the earth-extolling and ecology-worshipping neo-pantheists. Now that's quite a number of adjectives, I'm really proud of that one, who noisily swarm about not only in the twilight zone of the New Age, but in more normative locales of our culture as well. I think that's a great sentence. Now, in fact, the frequent reaction against these supposed features of Gnosticism is, I think, one of the best proofs of the real orientation of our culture. Insult the God of their fathers and people won't bat an eye. But cast doubt upon the earth and upon their bodies, then they shriek in anger and horror. Now what does this indicate? Well, I think it indicates that they are atheists and that they are materialists. Even if they think that they are, quote, spiritual, then they are what a certain Tibetan teacher called spiritual materialists. Well, now, after having thus knocked about some people and fulminated in my usual manner, I need to probably settle down a little bit at this point and bring a little bit closer Jung's position. Jung said about this issue of dualism, he said, "Gnosis is undoubtedly a psychological knowledge whose contents derive from the unconscious." And he defined it in more precise terms when he wrote, and I quote again, "Our aim is to create a wider personality whose center of gravity does not necessarily coincide with the ego, but which on the contrary may even thwart the ego tendencies. Like a magnet, the new center attracts to itself that which is proper to it, the signs of the Father," he uses a Gnostic term, "namely everything that pertains to the original and unalterable character of the individual ground plan. The same knowledge formulated differently to suit the age they lived in was possessed by the Gnostics." This is how he put it. So what are we dealing with here? A widening of the soul. Actually, Rudolf Steiner mentioned that term, das Weitwerden der Seele. Mm-hmm. The extension of that little circle of light that is around us and which is shed by our spirit but kind of carried forward by the little magician, our ego. This has to get wider. No longer being ego-centered, but the shifting of the psychological center of gravity to something that is beyond the ego. Now, what do I mean by that? You know, that's a little metaphor. Without gnosis, we are centered within our personal self. You know, it's sort of like a center of gravity that Newton spoke about, that the apple falls from the tree according to its center of gravity, that's what's going to hit the ground. So that is where our center of gravity is. But that center of gravity doesn't have to remain there. We don't have to remain the way we are. We don't have to stay within that small circle of light, just sort of circulating our own little light around, and not really include more than that. I'm not talking about intellectual inclusion now. Because you can take in ideas till the cows come home, you know, and that is not going to really widen your soul. The widening of the soul comes about, Jung would say, primarily by way of two things. And the first of those is the one that we've been talking about all evening. It's the reconciliation of the opposites. As soon as we are not caught in the constant tug of war of these opposites, good and evil, knowledge and ignorance, above and below, happiness and unhappiness, health and illness, going on and on and on, whatever it is, but we somehow have escaped that thraldom. We are not being pulled into their realm. We are not being pulled into their orbit. We are somewhere in between. Like those of you who are familiar with Kabbalah, like in the middle pillar. We are not bouncing back and forth between the Sephirot in Kabbalistic terms on the right hand, on the left hand pillar. We are on the middle pillar. And we have taken such useful, transformative, illuminative psychic energy as we were able to take from the opposites, and we brought it together. This is, of course, why Jung was so interested in alchemy, because that is very largely the alchemical principle, that the two come together and they fuse their energy and then something new comes about. And as we do that, we are moving toward wholeness, toward real totality. Now, Jung initially, as some of you probably know, when he was still in medical school and just about to get his doctorate, was involved in something that a lot of people were involved in at that time, and that was sort of spiritualistic type of activity. He had a young cousin, Helene Preiswerk, of his mother's family. I think that was, she was certainly a Preiswerk, I don't know, but I think she was Helen. In any event, this girl could go into trances and then would make all kinds of utterances. It was in the family, and Jung sat there and wrote them all down. And this went on for a considerable period of time, and then later on they gave it up. Well, the material that came forth when Jung studied it and analyzed it revealed to him that what was taking place here to a major extent was that the girl had within herself unintegrated part selves. And these unintegrated part selves, psychological principles or complexes within her, seized upon the opportunity to masquerade as persons. And then they came forth. And that this very often happens in spiritualistic or channeling type of situations. And then he saw that what were they trying to do? Were they just trying to express themselves? No. What he found was they were trying to get together with each other and with her. And so he discerned that the objective of all of this drama that was going on was unification. The cessation of these internal divisions, which don't show on the surface. I'm sure the girl looked like a perfectly healthy Swiss girl, you know. But they all tried to get together. They tried to get together. So that was the first recognition, that unification is the ultimate objective. Well, ultimate objective as far as human psychology is concerned. And then, later on, you know, give it another, what would it have been? Another 20 years or so, 16, 20 years or so, because that was around 1900. The seven sermons were written around 1916. Then he came to see that not only was this unification an important issue, a very all-important issue, but that the oppositional forces within the psyche were trying to reconcile, and to facilitate the reconciliation is a very, very important step toward that union. Now, since I have to conclude once again, how does this relate to the Gnostic, the original Gnostic mythos? Let me say once again, as I hope it's not redundant, too redundant what I said before, it's a little irony. God doesn't want neurotics in heaven. And to translate it into Gnostic terms, you have to psychologically, psycho-spiritually get your act together before you are really ready for transcendence. Otherwise, you are just going from having been a secular knot, you will have turned into a religious knot. And just, you know, having converted to Jesus, as they call him on the Sunday night television. Have you ever noticed that? That there is this, the way they pronounce the name reminds you of a certain dairy product. Jesus. Jesus. This born again and this, that, and the other thing will not do it. It may give the person a good feeling. It may even, you know, sort of tune them in for a while to something greater than themselves. But they have to come to a reconciliation of the opposites within themselves. They have to come to a union within themselves. Then they are ready for really great, liberating, final, ultimate gnosis. When you have become one, then you no longer belong into this world. Mm-hmm. When you have become one, then nothing in this world has any hold on you any longer. Not this opposite, not that opposite. Not the revolutionary opposite, let's say, of society that says, hey, you know, you have to stick around and help us change society, help us change the world, you know, change. Or on the other hand, let's say a conservative notion, say, listen, buddy, you know, you have to stay here and help us defend the establishment, defend the structure. And you know what? When you are one, you say, oh yeah. Well, you know, I have known you, and I have known you. And I am no longer of your kingdom. I, as the soul says in the Pistis Sophia, when the archons of the planets come up and say, where are you going? Where are you going? You belong to me. He says, no, I no longer belong to you. I am now going to get my inheritance up above. Okay? But in order to be able to do that, you have to have become powerful, you have to have become strong spiritually as the result of this interior unification. Now, as I see it, and I certainly stand to be corrected only on that point, by the way. Don't try to correct me on anything else, will you? Just on that point. That this was really Jung's forte. He tried to create an insight and a discipline whereby that internal unification could be accomplished, which then would make people ready for the true, ultimate liberating gnosis. And if he has indeed done something in that regard, and if we will discover yet more of the kind of insights and the kind of directions that he had from his unpublished writings, then I think we can be truly grateful to him for that, because that is a very, very great contribution. It's a signal contribution to the field of religion and a signal contribution to the field of the understanding of the psyche called psychology. So he has given us a great gift in both of these areas. And for that gift we can be, and indeed should be, eternally grateful. And how this expresses itself further and leads to that insight and that liberation, to that our next discussion will be devoted, until which time I bid you good night and I thank you very much.
Copyright MMD by BC Recordings. Catalog number 100903. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.ORG.